welcome back to Doing It. So you may or may not know, but I am currently working towards becoming a certified sexuality educator through a course at ICEE, which stands for the Institute for Sexuality Education and Enlightenment. And whilst I have mixed feelings about if you need a qualification or what kind of qualification you need to become a sex educator, because I already am one without this course, there are still a lot of things that I have been learning from the classes and webinars that I have been taking. And one of those things that came up was about sex addiction and how it isn't real, which blew my little mind as a person who lives in a society where the narrative is that sex addiction is a real thing. But this is a new thing I've recently come across, so I didn't feel like I could do the topic justice myself, so I have roped in an expert. My guest today is Silva Neves, who is a psychosexual and relationship psychotherapist and author, and he's here to dispel all of the myths around sex addiction and give us a better framework to view sexual behavior through. We talk about the difference between the public idea of sex addiction and the understanding of it in a sex therapy clinic. And Silva gives us a rundown on what the definition of an addiction is, and so how things like sex and porn addictions don't fit. We also talk about problems with 12-step sex addiction programs, how they become about avoidance and seeing all sexuality as bad and trying to fix a problem that doesn't really exist. And so then we get on to compulsive sexual behaviors, which is what someone who might think they are a sex addict could be experiencing. And we talk about the causes of these and the potential distress caused by them, like shame, mental health issues, sexual trauma, and chronic stress. And then towards the end, we get on to answering your questions. And so for that section, we talk a lot about sexual trauma, and I give another warning before we start talking about that at the time, so you can skip that part if you need to. We don't explicitly talk about sexual violence, but we talk more around coping with sexual trauma and talking about it with a therapist. As usual, you can find more info and links to everything we talked about in this episode in the show notes over at doingitpodcast.co.uk. And please let us know what you think over on our Twitter or Instagram, which is at doingitpodcast. And if you like this episode, please leave us a rating and review over on iTunes. It is really appreciated and really helps us out. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Silva Neves. Silva, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to kind of get into your brain and unpick all of the wisdom and knowledge.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So basically, like, I wanted to chat with you about sex addiction, what it is, what it maybe isn't, and then compulsive sexual behaviors. And this might be new information to some listeners, and this was new information to me like this year, which is that sex addiction is not a thing. It is not real. And I was like, wait, what? Because it's so, I guess, pervasive in like our culture and media messaging and stuff around sex. So where do we begin? Like, why is sex addiction an idea or a framework that we have, and why is it maybe not the most useful thing? And then we can move on to what we should actually be using.
Sure. When we speak about addiction in general, anyway, there are two different ways that we talk about it. There is the public way and there is the clinical way.
Yeah.
And those two are different. So everybody in the public that don't have a clinical background, of course, they use the term addict in all sorts of different ways. I'm a coffee addict, I'm a Netflix addict, I'm a shopping addict, whatever. And usually when people say that, what they mean is that they do something that they love very much and sometimes maybe overdo it. And that's how we talk about.
Right. So I'm a Pringles addict.
Right. Exactly. I'm a cheese addict. There you go.
Nice. I don't think there's anything wrong with being a cheese addict.
But no, I don't think so either. But, you know. But of course, on the clinical sense, addiction have a very, very different meaning, because to define something an addiction clinically, it has to meet five important criteria that if they are not met, then we can't define it as an addiction. And so those criteria are, I'm just going to say it very briefly, what they are, so that people can really understand what a real addiction is. Is that first, it has to be something with a problem with impulse control. And so it means people just having urges about something and just not being able to control that, and then just launching into the behavior. The second is risky use. So what that means is that people have to do something that they know is harming themselves and they can't stop doing it. And in the clinical criteria of addiction, it means that it's something that could be a significant risk of death. Okay, that's the risky use bit. So, you know, somebody that is told, if you drink more, you're going to be dying by the end of this year. Or if you take drugs, you're likely to have an overdose and you're likely to die quite soon. So that kind of risk we're talking about in terms of addiction.
Okay. If the risk factor isn't that high, because there's obviously like a whole spectrum of risk, would it not count as an addiction?
That's right. That's right.
Oh, okay. So it has to be like really serious.
It has to be a life and death type of risk or serious physical harm. The third one is what we call tolerance. So tolerance is basically when there is a substance that goes into the brain that the brain is not naturally cannot process. So usually it would be drugs and alcohol. And so for the brain to survive that kind of chemicals, it has to reconfigure itself to sustain the chemical. And that's when the brain is actually changing, because the chemical is an external substance. And then when the brain has reconfigured, then the substance that is taken to produce a high, for example, does not produce a high any longer, because the brain has habituated to it. So then people have to take more of that substance to achieve the same high.
Got it.
And so that's what we call tolerance. And so it means also that then the other criteria is withdrawal. And withdrawal, when we talk about withdrawal, we mean that it's an actual body tissue pain that people have. And actually the body can go into shock, and it can be quite dangerous to stop a substance so quickly, so soon. So that has to be medically supervised. And the reason why there is a withdrawal in that way is because when the substance is taken away from the brain, then the brain goes into shock and has to reconfigure itself again back to its original setting, which can take quite some time.
So those are
some of like the main kind of criteria for a clinical addiction.
Yeah, that's so interesting as well, because like you're saying, like substances like drugs and alcohol is like the obvious ones that we think of. So in that sense, like, can you not be addicted to certain behaviors? Does it have to be a substance? Because when you were saying about tolerance as well, that reminds me of the way that some people talk about porn use. Does that have like the kind of like tolerance effect, but maybe not the other one, so it wouldn't count as an addiction?
Even with pornography, we've not actually seen tolerance clinically. So when it's very common that people say, oh, I've been watching something on porn and then it stops being pleasurable. So now I'm just clicking on other things to watch something different and then watch something different.
Yeah. We hear a lot of people saying that they've become desensitized to certain things. And so then they are looking for like more and more extreme things to like get that arousal.
Of course, and people mistake that with tolerance, but it's actually not a tolerance, because the brain is not impaired. The porn cannot impair the brain in the way that drugs can. So what it is really is that it's two things. First is boredom, and that comes and that comes with novelty seeking. We, as human beings, we like to have, we seek novelty because it's exciting and it's fun, and we all do it, right? We don't always like to eat the same food every day. We like to sometimes change what we eat, and sometimes we like to eat something we've never eaten before for that extra bit of excitement.
Yeah. And how sometimes your favorite meal might eventually like get boring and you need to change it up a bit before you then go back to that meal.
Yes, absolutely, exactly. So that's one of those things that and people mistake that. They think, oh yes, gosh, it's tolerance and porn is bad, but it's not. It's just novelty seeking. And of course, on porn, there's always a lot of novelty seeking because there's always something more that you can click on. You will never expire the whole kind of library of porn available out there.
Yeah.
But the other thing that people mistake tolerance for is when people say, oh, I don't feel pleasure with sex anymore, and often people think, oh, well, that's because then the brain is impaired. And so the pleasure of sex is no longer present and you have to do more to get the same kind of pleasure of sex.
Mm.
And again, that's really not been observed clinically. It's people that mistake it for tolerance, but it's not. The issue with people that report not feeling pleasure with sex is because they are in dissociation, not tolerance, and that's very different.
Ah, okay. Do you want to briefly explain what disassociation is?
Well, I can explain very easily because it happens to all of us. Say you go to the cinema and you have a big bucket of popcorn and you sit down and you watch all the exciting trailers, and then by the time the film starts, you just look down at your bucket and it's all empty and you think, what the hell happened? I didn't even taste the popcorn. What, you know? That's because you ate the popcorn in dissociation, because you were focusing on something else.
Mm.
But if the next time you go to the cinema and you have your bucket of popcorn and you eat your popcorn mindfully,
mm-hmm.
and you're aware of the popcorn, then you will have the same pleasure of the popcorn that you would have done the time before. So it's not that you're tolerant. It's not that you become tolerant to popcorn. It's not that you're addicted to popcorn. It's just that you were in dissociation. And with sex, that's what happens a lot. People who don't get the pleasure of it, often that's because their mind is somewhere else. They think of something else and they're not present with the experience of sex, and therefore they're not getting the pleasure of it.
Yeah.
But if the next time they decide to be, or they learn to be mindful about what they're doing with their body in a sexual situation, then the pleasure, they will then feel the pleasure as they would have in the first time around. It does not mean that they have become tolerant to it.
Okay, yeah. And that makes a lot of sense to me as well, because I have seen a lot of people doing work around like mindfulness and sex and like sensate focus and
yes.
things like that. So, yeah. Pay attention to your popcorn, people.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes the confusion between people out there is, you know, when people think they are sex addicts, is because mm-hmm. they are confusing the popular term, which is the one that we all use. You know, I'm a cheese addict, you're a Pringles addict, and people will say they're sex addict. But often what they mean is, I love sex very, very much, and I sometimes overdo it. Or they might say, a lot of the time they might say, I've got problems with my sexual behaviors because I don't understand it and it feels out of control.
Mm.
And feeling out of control does not mean being out of control. So, and that's also an important distinction that a lot of people are confused about. But they use the term sex addict because the public does not have any other terms. That's the most popular term that everybody uses. And it's not challenged. And so people keep using that term.
Yeah. And because it's so common and it's what kind of like people use and understand, like, as far as I'm aware, there are like sex addict anonymous groups that have like a similar kind of like 12-step kind
yes.
of programs. And one of the things that I was learning about in my course was just how like these don't work for sex addiction because it's not an addiction. And I wondered if that's something that you've come across.
Yes, absolutely. It doesn't work, but also, for me, what's worse is that it also gives people a mindset, a particular mindset of fearing sex and being erotically avoidant rather than erotically aware. And if you're going to be erotically avoidant, you're not going to be helped because you're going to always be in the dark about what's going on in your erotic mind and what's going on in your body. And if all you learn is about avoiding sexual cues or erotic content in whatever, you know, magazines and mm-hmm. TV or whatever, because you're afraid that that's going to trigger you, and I use trigger in inverted commas here, it's kind of really, really not helpful.
Mm.
And the other thing that's not helpful about those 12-step programs is that people confuse a problem, like a sexual behavior problem, and an identity. You know, people say, I'm a sex addict. And well, actually, that's not true. You are a human person.
Yeah.
And you might have some problems with sexual behaviors that might be compulsive. And that's really quite different. And as soon as people identify with a movement or they identify with a problem, like I'm a sex addict, they are the people usually that are becoming very aggressive or reluctant to hear something different. And of course, I know that because I'm usually the one who talks about, hey, actually, sex addiction is not really clinically endorsed. And there's other ways to look at it. There's other ways to manage your sexual behaviors in a different way. And then they become very angry. They often tell me, you are denying who I am. You're denying what I feel. Yeah. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not denying who you are because you're a human being. But I also don't agree that sex addiction is an identity. It's a problem. And so it's really about actually, you know, when I speak against sex addiction, I'm not trying to deny people's problems or deny people's identity. Mm-hmm. I want to understand it more and better in a deeper way so that I can help better. But often people are that feel that their movement is under attack. They then will be quite aggressive about it. I understand, you know, if you have certain, if you believe in something so bad, and somebody tells you something different, they will be defensive. I really understand that. I'm not angry at them. You know, it's like, you know, people that really, really believe that the earth was flat. Well, you know, as soon as somebody said, actually, you know what, it's round. What? That did not come down well very easily, you know, the new knowledge.
But a lot of the times because they identify as a flat earther, not because they identify necessarily as a human being who has ideas that can be challenged or changed depending on what new information they're given, but like their beliefs are like a core part of their identity. So by challenging the belief, you're also like challenging, like you said, like who they are.
Yes, that's right. And there are so many research in psychology that shows that that your behaviors will naturally follow what you believe about yourself. So if you believe you're a sex addict, you're more likely to act like one. and so again, that's another way that's just not really very helpful. And one of the things is that people that do go to those programs or they follow an addiction-oriented therapy, they often complain about relapse, you know, what they call relapse, meaning that their behaviors don't change or they return to their sexual behaviors that they didn't want to have. And people just struggle so much with relapse after relapse after relapse. And every single time they then blame themselves. They think, oh, that's because I didn't follow the steps properly. That's because I didn't do the program well. I failed therapy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those relapse are induced by the very programs themselves. Mm-hmm. So, and so that's also harming them because they hardly ever say, maybe the 12th step is not good for me. Maybe I need to look for something else. They say, I failed the 12th step.
Yeah. 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 It becomes a personal failure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, not helpful either.
So one of the other things that I came across was just in general, like our, as a society, as a world, our lack of understanding about really the scope of human sexuality and how we have a very like narrow definition of what is normal and what is healthy. And so often if anyone falls outside of that, which is in fact like most people, then you might be like, oh my goodness, am I a sex addict? Because you don't feel like you like fit into this mold. And someone said to me, they were like, yeah, you might get a therapist who thinks that you're a sex addict because you either have more or different sex to them because of just the complete lack of understanding that we have about sexuality.
Yes, that's right. That's absolutely right. In sexuality in general, so many people are really not understanding the diversity of sexual practices and sexual behaviors and even sexual turn-ons. That's primarily because sex education is very poor here in the UK, but in most countries, sex education is poor, so nobody gets to spend enough time to exploring their erotic mind and exploring what kind of sex and sexual behavior is going to be good for them and fit them. Mm-hmm. So they only go with what society tells us what sex should be like, again, in inverted commas. Yeah. And all those shoulds are usually the things that cause a lot of problems in people's sex lives, because so many people, there's such a diversity of erotic minds and, mm-hmm. and eroticism and sensuality and turn-ons, that a lot of people are going to fall outside of that very strict kind of should that society tells us. And so many people feel very shamed about their turn-ons, their sexual desire and their sexual behaviors, because they think it's not normal. Yeah. And of course, as a psychosexual therapist like me, or any sex educators out there, those words healthy or normal is really ghastly for us, right?
Yeah, it's like red flags.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. So many people live by those, because and they beat themselves up for not being, you know, normal, as society says. And then in the if those behaviors happen to be a kink that's unusual, for yeah. example, or somebody who has a high sexual desire and have a lot of sex, or people that have sexual practices that are just a little bit that they've never heard of before, they might think, oh, I have a problem. Oh, that must be, I'm a sex addict. You know, as soon mm-hmm. as it's something to do with frequency or the unusual practice, people start to think they're sex addict.
Yeah.
And then they might read books about it, or they might go online and do an online test about it. And then they will show up their sex addicts because...
Oh my goodness. I so now just like want to Google like sex addict quiz and like see what comes up. I bet there's so much like, am I a sex addict quizzes. Don't take them, people. Don't do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, don't take them, because there's no, you know, sex addiction is not clinically endorsed in the first place. So uh-huh. those quizzes, you know, the assessment of those quizzes are done by the moral judgment of the creator of the quizzes. Mm. And usually the creator of the quizzes are those selling services about it.
Ooh, so. Yeah. And I think you just nailed it there with like what you said about it's individuals' moral judgment. And when we're using morality to judge other people's sexual behavior, like, again, that's just like red flags.
Yes, big red flags. But a lot of people will, because of that, a lot of people will self-diagnose as a sex addict and then try to find help for that. And, you know, one of the things I do a lot in my consulting rooms is to undiagnose people who say they're sex addict. Of course, you know, if they come in and say, I'm a sex addict, I'm not going to say, no, you're wrong. This is not what we call it. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not like that, of course. You know, I use their language too, but at the same time I also say, and you know, that is something that, you know, sex addiction is a disease word, and actually you're not diseased.
Yeah,
and
they might be like, well, why do you think that, what's your yeah. sex life like? And then it might just be having to be like, actually, that all sounds really normal to me.
Yes. And well, sometimes normalizing some of the things they do and say is good. You have to look at the distress. You know, what is so what bothers them so much? Because there are some sexual practices that might be completely normative, but it might be going against their values, or whether it's religious values or any kind of values. And so that's fine. We have to listen to that too, and listen mm-hmm. to where the distress is. But if the distress comes from an external source, like a book that says they're a porn addict, or a therapist that says they're sex addict, or a quiz that says they're sex addict, those are external stuff that doesn't know them really. And so usually then when people say I'm a sex addict, what they're saying is, I feel a lot ashamed about my sexuality. That's what they're saying often underneath. Yeah. Or they're saying, I really don't understand my sexual processes, and I don't understand how I react to sexual cues, and I think there's something wrong. That's what they're usually saying. So mm-hmm. as a therapist, I don't go for the label. I explain to them, you know, what is clinically endorsed, what is not, and given, and with what we know clinically and scientifically, they definitely don't have an addiction, so they're not diseased, and they may have some compulsivity traits and definitely sexual behaviors. And we can look at that and look at what is underneath, what is going on for them as the individual.
Yes. And that is a great way to segue into compulsive sexual behaviors then. So actually, like, what is the antidote to this? And what are compulsive sexual behaviors? And I guess, like, clinically, how, I don't know, is it something that you diagnose people with, or like, how do you, how does that work in a kind of like clinical setting?
In a clinical setting, the only criteria that we have to assess compulsive sexual behaviors is from the World Health Organization, and they came out with a diagnostic criteria from 2018, so mm-hmm. it's quite recent. And so if it's not perfect, obviously, because people are still trying to figure it out. But if you go by those criteria, I think it's very helpful, because just like the addiction, the clinical definition of addiction, with compulsive sexual behavior, if you want to diagnose somebody with a disorder, they have to meet a set of criteria. It's quite a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And actually, most people don't meet those criteria. So most people then will not be labeled with a disorder, which I think is very important, people not to feel they have a disease when they don't. Mm-hmm. But if they meet some of those criteria, not others, then I said to them, well, you don't have a disorder. That's the good news. But what you are coming up with is some sexual behavior problems. You know, they are problems. It's not a disorder. And so mm-hmm. it's very different. And for me, the words are very important, because I just don't like to put some disease or pathology language onto people if there aren't any. And mm-hmm. and a lot of people are already pathologizing themselves enough when it comes to sex. There's no point adding to it, and especially from a professional, I don't think it's right to do.
Yeah.
So the criteria that we have from the World Health Organization says that it's not an addiction, mm-hmm. it's an impulse control issue. And impulse control means that it's people finding it hard to manage their urges and the intense urges. Mm-hmm. And the urges lead to then repetitive sexual behaviors that are unwanted. So it's not about the frequency of behaviors.
Okay.
It's about how they manage their impulse.
And by unwanted, is that by the person who is exhibiting these behaviors, or could it also
yes.
be like unwanted for other people as well? Like, so say if someone like is an exhibitionist, maybe it's unwanted for maybe other people in public who happen to see that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yes.
That's illegal.
Yes. I'm glad you bring that up, because there's with the sex addiction field, there's also a lot of confusion between what is legal and what is not legal. Mm. And even in the sex addiction 12-step programs, they put everything together. The people that sexually offend with the people that have compulsive sexual behaviors with consensual adults. And those, to me,
they
are very different issues, very different problems. But in the sex addiction field, people just mix those two up together, thinking that one leads to the other, and somehow it's kind of like on the same line. And I disagree with that totally.
Right.
Most people that have compulsive sexual behaviors, they have behaviors that might be unwanted for them, or it might be against their commitment to their partner, but it is done consensually and it's all legal. People who sexually offend is very, very different problem. And I don't think that's the same at all.
Okay. Yeah. No, so, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, for, you know, your example of exhibitionism, people can do that in a legal way if everybody consents to. So obviously mm-hmm. not in the street, but some people do have a turn on of exhibition and, you know, with other people. But you know, as long as it's all talked about before and so on.
Yeah.
And these people, and there are some people that even get turned on by that only, or mostly by exhibitioning themselves. And again, that's not a problem if it doesn't cause distress to them. So that's fine. But of course, there are some people who might be in a relationship with somebody who does not like that type of stuff. And they say, you know, stop doing that and just do something more kind of vanilla or more normal, you know, again, inverted commas. And then that person just then trying to meet their needs. And then they realize, well, I don't get turned on so much unless I do exhibitionism. And then they think, well, surely I've got a problem, because I should be able to do the other stuff. And then that's when people start to think they have a problem.
Mm.
So often it's to do with how they think they fit with the rest of their lives, or how their sexuality fits with the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the rest of the World Health Organization criteria?
So that's one of them. It's like the distress has to be a distress mm-hmm. that comes from them, not an external source. And it has to be a distress mm-hmm. that is big enough that's mm-hmm. going to cause problems in the other areas of people's lives. And one of the
right.
criteria is to say that it also has to be, sex has to be the central focus of people's lives to the extent of causing problems. And that is an important bit, because a lot of people have sex on their mind all the time. It's the central focus of people's lives. But if it doesn't cause problems, then it's not a problem, basically. So, you know, for example, for me, you know, mm-hmm. I'm a psychosexual yeah. therapist. I talk about sex. I work with people's sex lives, and I write about sex all day long. It's the central focus of my life. And right. So yeah. if that was the only part of the criteria, I could be diagnosed with you know, somebody with compulsive sexual behaviors, but I'm not, because it doesn't affect looking after myself. I can feed myself. I can sleep well. I can meet all of my other obligations. I can connect with my friends and my colleagues everything else. So it's if sex mm-hmm. trumps everything else, and they ignore other obligations of their mm-hmm. lives, and they cannot manage their lives, then that can be one of the criteria. And with that, you know, I have to yeah. say, though, that certainly with the clients I see, they often say to me, oh, yes, I've been doing that behavior, you know, basically cheating. You know, that's what people say. Now, I've been cheating with my partner for years, and so I've got sex addiction. And they've been doing that quite successfully, unnoticed. And so, you know, if they can mm-hmm. have a double life unnoticed and manage all of their diaries unnoticed, then that means they have pretty high functioning of their lives.
It's a big scheduling involved,
but, you know, it means that they manage and all of their obligations yeah. and also do their sexual behaviors. So clinically, this person would not classify as having a disorder.
Okay. But they might have some ethical issues to work out in their relationship.
Yes, they might have some ethical issues to work out in their relationship. They might have a bit, you know, learning a bit more awareness of the impact that non-consensual, non-monogamy does to a relationship. They might also need to be a bit mm-hmm. clearer about the erotic mind and what is the motivation behind doing that stuff that is not part of their commitment. Mm-hmm. But that is really kind of quite different from having a disorder.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like, we're not going to pathologize like every single person who has
exactly
like cheated on their partner as being like, there is something like mentally wrong with you.
Yeah, because if we did that, then there will be over half the population that would have a disorder.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. It is a lot of people. For sure.
And one of the other things that's really important is part of the criteria is that the behavior has to last for at least 6 months
okay.
or more. And that is very important too, because some people sometimes notice that the sexual behavior changes quite suddenly, and it changes. And so then they feel it becomes out of control because it's out of character for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they run straight away to a therapist and say, oh, I've got sex addiction or compulsive sexual behavior because my behavior has just changed, and it's only changed over the last month or 2 or 3 months, then we cannot diagnose with anything, because usually it's response to something that's just happened.
Yeah, something situational.
Yeah, the most common thing is if somebody had a very, very important bereavement, it's really, really likely that those people will respond to that with a surge in sexual behaviors, and that feels quite compulsive.
That feels like a minor side character plot in the latest series of Sex Education. There was one of the characters, their cat died, and they wouldn't talk about it, but just wanted sex from their partner all of the time. And that was how they were coping with grief. And that was just like this minor little side plot on the show.
Oh, right. Well, that's fantastic. And that's exactly how it is. And this is a normal coping mechanism faced with a big grief.
Mm.
So it's not a pathology. It's not bad. It's not wrong. If somebody comes with these issues and it's just been between 1 to 6 months, then we just have to help that person with their grief, mm-hmm. you know, and be there and listen and open the space, but not do any clinical intervention for compulsive sexual behaviors. Because usually the compulsion then wanes without any active clinical treatment after a while.
Mm-hmm. So when it then comes to people who do tick those boxes and they exhibit compulsive sexual behaviors, what tends to be the kind of like underlying causes like of that?
The one,
what can we blame?
Yes, well, yes, exactly. Well, there is the one most important is chronic stress, basically. Mm. So for true compulsivity to be assessed as compulsivity and to be treated, it has to be chronic stress, because if there's no chronic stress, there's no compulsivity.
Ah.
So it's different from somebody having a terrible day at work and they're going to then go and see a sex worker to soothe that terrible day at work. That is, as you were saying earlier, situational. It's about, you know, one speck of stress and you use sex to manage that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not compulsivity. Compulsivity is if people are using sex every day on a regular basis, on a very frequent basis, with super urges of feeling sexual because of managing something that's chronic underneath, a chronic disturbance.
Right. So it's almost like using sex to avoid something else that is going on, maybe.
Yes, exactly. It's to avoid feeling the chronic stress.
Yeah.
So people use, you know, pleasure and turn mm-hmm. on and excitement to move away from the unpleasant feelings of chronic stress. And chronic stress can be anything from being in a crappy job, for example. You know, people that are in a job that they hate, and they're working all day long, 5 days a week, and then the weekend they recover, and then it's Monday too quickly, and then they do it again, and they feel trapped in that. That is enough chronic stress for sexual compulsivity to exist mm-hmm. and to survive.
And I guess things like identity stresses as well.
Yeah. Identity stress, minority stress,
yeah.
all sorts of that stuff is really part of chronic stress. You know, really feeling bad in your skin or feeling bad about yourself on a regular basis, basically. But often, you know, people don't walk around and say, "Oh, I feel worthless." You know, that feeling is a feeling that's embedded inside, but they don't necessarily have the intellectual word, "I feel worthless," but they feel it deep inside and they can't access it with words, but they can feel it. And that's that disturbance underneath that they can't often access logically, that is the one pulling the strings and creates chronic stress and therefore then sexual compulsivity. But chronic stress sometimes can be also a result of unresolved post-trauma.
Mm.
So it could be anything that's happened in childhood, from an accident to sexual abuse to neglect, you know, difficult parents. And then, of course, out of childhood experiences like this, people do also come out of that with core beliefs like, "I'm not good enough, I'm unlovable, I'm unlikable, mm-hmm. I'm worthless." And then that will be then those same things that can create a chronic stress in people's lives. And then they manage it with sexual compulsivity and they don't even realize that it's all linked back mm-hmm. to some events that's happened in childhood.
Yeah. And so I think it's like one of those things where when it involves sex, we just kind of like, we all kind of get in a frenzy about it being sex that is the bad thing, and like porn is evil, and like, you know, sexuality is an eroticism is what's bad. But actually, like, what's going on is it's just like an expression of other mental health stuff that is going on. And it just so happens that sexual related behaviors is like how that expresses for some people.
That's right. Yes.
But it's not like the bad thing that is causing this is like sexual images in society and like
no.
all of that
no.
kind of stuff.
Absolutely mm-hmm. not. No, it's not, you know, nothing's broken. The sexuality is not broken. They don't have a sexualized brain that's bad. It's none of that. It's just mm-hmm. one thing that they have learned to use, and they've learned along the way that orgasm feels good, and therefore that's when they are busy with that, they're not busy with feeling bad, and so that's a coping mechanism. Some people choose other coping mechanisms. Like, it's very quite common for people to have a very, very bad or busy, stressful work week, and on the mm-hmm. weekend they binge on Netflix all weekend long. They do nothing but watch Netflix mm-hmm. all weekend long. On Monday, they go back to their colleagues and they say, oh, yes, I spent the whole weekend on binging on Netflix. And nobody says anything. They say, oh, right, okay, well, have fun. Oh, okay, yeah. Great.
Whereas if you were like, I spent the entire weekend having orgies.
Yeah, then that's very
people
different.
People will be like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Exactly. Or even I spent the whole weekend masturbating to porn. People will be like, oh, God, that's so bad. But, you know, what is the difference between, you know, scrolling on your phone to move away from unpleasant emotions, watching Netflix, mm-hmm. You know, going away to a spa weekend or watching pornography or having lots of sex mm-hmm. with your partner or strangers? You know, it's the same thing. It's using something that is pleasurable to avoid something that's unpleasant or to soothe mm-hmm. from a bad week or stressful times.
Yeah. And like you said about it needing to be 6 months or longer, like I feel like if a friend of mine said that basically like every night after work and every weekend, they just spend all of their spare time watching Netflix, I would, and that was like 6 months or longer, I would be concerned about them as well.
Yes, right, exactly. If you say, well, I've not turned up to work and I've avoided friends' birthday parties and I lied to my friends that I couldn't turn up to their party because I just wanted to watch Netflix all day long, then you think, okay, that's a problem.
Yeah, because then that's when it's like interfering in other parts of your life.
Exactly,
for sure.
But it doesn't mean they're addicted to Netflix. It just means that they're using it and they're overusing it because there's a disturbance underneath that they are not resolving.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so I've got some questions from Instagram, and it kind of relates to what you were saying about some of it can be due to like sexual trauma. And so we do have questions about that. So listeners, please take care of yourselves if you don't want to hear about this, basically. Somebody asked how to have healthy sexual relationships after going through sex-related trauma. Big question.
So it's a big question, and I won't be able to answer in the time that we have on this podcast.
Yeah.
But one of the main things to be really conscious of is to be absolutely sure of what feels right and what does not feel right for you. Mm. And so, for example, people that have had sexual trauma in the past, there might be parts of their body that they just do not want to be touched. Mm-hmm. And there might be some words that they do not want to be spoken, or there might be some things in their sexual space, say, for example, if the sexual space in the bedroom, there might be some things that they just can't, that cannot be there. For example, certain scent or certain colors or certain texture, mm-hmm. or there might be some sexual positions that just is a no-no for them.
Yeah.
So they have to absolutely know what that is for them, the things that remind them of trauma compared to the things that don't. And then to be absolutely super clear to tell their partners about it, the sexual partners about it, to say, you know, for example, you cannot have aftershave when we have sex, and it is not possible to say words like to say dirty words, and missionary position is a no-no for me. Right. Mm-hmm. You can't touch me on my breast, but you can touch me on my buttock. You know, these kind of things are going to be important, because then you have a map and you recruit your partner as a team player.
Mm-hmm.
And together you can work out how you can have sex that is not a reminder of the sexual trauma.
Yeah.
And I think that would be like, that's like the number one suggestion, really, I would have.
Yeah. If the person wants to, is there a way to approach, like, with a sexual partner, expanding their comfort zone? Or is that something best worked on, like, with a therapist?
Yes, of course, with a therapist, it's always better, because there's plenty more time to slow down the process. Often people rush mm-hmm. into wanting to experiment, and sometimes it's important to not rush and to take more time. But if they want to expand their sexual horizon or different behaviors, they have to make sure that they are super, super, super safe with their partner, that they mm-hmm. feel that their partner will be able to respond immediately if they say, oh, actually, no, that's not working out for me, or, oh, actually, no, you need to stop right now. And the partner has to be responsive immediately without any questions or without any trying more. And so that's another bit of safety.
And this is where things like safe words, but also being really tuned in with your partner's body language is super useful, even in like a vanilla context
as
well. Yes,
that's right. And if there is something that goes wrong, because sometimes we're not always aware of all the kind of trauma triggers that we might have, if something goes wrong and the person has to absolutely say, okay, let's stop now, and then they have to figure out what could be the soothing ritual that needs to happen afterwards, after something has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. For some people, they just want to be by themselves with their partners, not around. And other people would prefer to have a hug from their partner or to talk to them about it. So they have to really know in advance what will be the soothing thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Somebody asked how to approach sexual trauma with my therapist. I'm not really comfy talking about it yet.
Yes, well, that's a very good question. I think that there are some therapists that are not trained in trauma, actually. So before you speak to about sexual trauma to your therapist, you might want to ask them questions about their training and their experience. And as a client, you have the absolute right to be asking your therapist for their qualifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if the therapist says, I'm not trauma trained and I don't have very much experience with sexual trauma, then don't talk to that therapist about it. But you might want to find a specialist in that area to address that bit of your life.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then even just approaching it then, if your therapist is trauma trained, what's kind of like the best way for someone who's maybe feeling a bit apprehensive and like bringing that up?
Very small step at a time, just to make sure that you can also feel that it's okay and safe enough for you to do it. Because even if your therapist is trauma trained, there might be something about your therapist that reminds you of your abuser. It could be the gender, or it could be the same eye color, it could be the same tone of voice, it could be the shirt they're wearing that day, right? So if you don't feel quite comfortable at the time, figure out what might not be comfortable about the therapist. If it's just the shirt, you might think maybe next time they wear a different shirt, that might be fine. If it's that they're a man and your abuser was a man and you don't feel comfortable talking about it to another man, even if it's a therapist that is trauma trained, then don't, you know. But if you feel like you can talk to your therapist about it, but you don't want to launch into it, just go very slow, just one little bit at a time, only the little bit that you feel okay to say. And as you speak it at loud, one bit at a time, keep checking with yourself and stop and take plenty of breaths, because even if you're really comfortable with your therapist anyway, this is the best way to talk about the trauma without re-traumatizing yourself, is by very small little bits and pieces, not the whole thing at once.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Because I guess just kind of being like, and this is what happened, and just kind of like laying it all out might be a bit intense as a first session.
Yes, and sometimes it's too intense. And then people can start to relive the trauma rather than explaining it. So it's really important to really, again, take plenty of time and just one little bit at a time.
Okay, yeah. So this question's a bit different. Someone asked how to deal with disturbing, gross, distressing, intrusive thoughts during sex.
Well, that's a good one. If it's intrusive, as in it's really stopping that person from having sex, then it's just to look at what are those thoughts there for. What is the function of those thoughts? What they are trying to say? Because sometimes it could be linked to a belief about sex. For example, some people think semen is gross, and so then they might just have that gross thought in their mind. And the other times it could be that it's something to do with thinking that they think it's gross, but actually it might be a turn on. Like, for example, they might just think, I don't know, feet are gross in normal life, but in the sexual context, I kind of quite like it, but the brain hasn't really quite managed to think of, I'm not in a living room context, I'm in a bedroom context, I'm in an erotic context, and something can be different. So sometimes it could be something like this. A lot of the time it could be about shame, about thinking sex is gross because that's where they were raised to be like that. But other times, some people have intrusive thoughts that could be really, really quite distressing. For example, thoughts like I'm a pedophile, or thoughts like I'm a rapist, or I'm harming my partner. And those thoughts can sometimes come and in the sexual area, and it can be really, really distressing because, of course, nobody wants to think of themselves as a rapist while they have sex with their partner or as a pedophile. Mm-hmm. And those thoughts are usually something to do with what we call extreme fear or acute fear, because they sometimes our brain takes us to the worst possible scenario that you can think of yourself. And of course, if people mm-hmm. think of themselves as pedophile and rapist, that would be like the worst that can possibly be.
Yeah.
And sometimes it reflects that there is an anxiety about it. It does not mean at all that you have tendencies to be a rapist or pedophile. It's just an acute fear as the worst thing that could be. So that is best to address with a therapist that is specialized in OCD. Because those thoughts are classified as compulsive obsessive part of it's not just behavior. Sometimes you can have obsessive compulsive thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And actually, I had a kind of like final question, which is about how, because not everyone can access therapy or like a really specialized sex therapist. And so what is something that you would want to kind of like impart to our listeners as a therapist in terms of like this? I don't know. There's a lot of pressure in this question, I'm now realizing. But like probably the vast majority of people listening probably aren't in any kind of sex therapy. But what advice would you want to give to people?
I think my best advice would be to continue to expose themselves to sex positive content. Like your podcast, for example, is fantastic. And there are lots of other people like sex educators and sex therapists that do their own mm-hmm. podcast as well. They put some fantastic content on Instagram or on other social media platforms. There are some people that have published some sex positive books that are really, really good. Look at them, expose yourself to them, keep learning about it, because the more you learn about the right and accurate information about sex positivity mm-hmm. and what sexuality is and the diversity of sexual behaviors and turn on and all of that, the more you will be able to understand a bit more your erotic mind and the less mm-hmm. you're likely to feel shame about your own turn ons or your own behaviors. So that would be my first advice if you can't afford therapy or if you don't want to go to therapy.
Yeah. And you also like have Instagram as well and post a lot of stuff on there too, and I guess by kind of like exposing yourself to a lot of that kind of information either through like social media content or books or podcasts or whatever it is, it like helps to normalize things, but it's also like equipping you with, like you said, the correct information, because there's so much misinformation out there about sex and relationships and even just kind of like we were saying about sex addiction, just in terms of like the pervasive messages that are culturally dominant in our society and how we just kind of, we hear them and we just accept that that is how sexuality works and that's how people are. But yeah, by exposing yourself to more of like the current understandings of these things can definitely just really help, because I feel like so much of it is just kind of like telling people that they're normal.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, isn't it? And earlier you used the term red flags, and I think that's important too. And that would be my second advice, actually, is like mm-hmm. if you hear anybody, whether it's a therapist, a professional, people with long letters after their names, or anybody on social media, or any books that you read that sound really black and white, like healthy, unhealthy, good, bad, wrong, whatever, you know, learn to put a red flag on that, because sexuality is never right, wrong, good, bad. It's not binary like that. It's not black and white, because mm-hmm. everybody is so different. So if you hear anyone that says porn is bad, anonymous sex is wrong, sex work is bad, you know, all that kind of stuff that is really quite prevalent, put a red flag and to say, hey, that's somebody's opinion. It's not facts.
Yeah, yeah. That's so true. Well, Silver, thank you so much for joining me and explaining all of this stuff and answering our questions. Where can people find more of your work online and also your book?
Yes, I've got a website. That's silvernevis.co.uk. That's my website for my clinical services, but I also have another website called sexpositivityuk.com, and that has some information and some resources for sex positivity and for the good sex education information out there. So those are the websites you can follow. If you want to contact me directly, you can find my details on my website. And I also have a book on compulsive sexual behavior that's been published by Routledge, and you can find that on Amazon.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. Bye.
Thank you.